Okay, looking at my notes, I have here that in summer of 67, with the addition of Kent and John Berman, that this is the show band version of Nickel
Oh, yeah.
Revolution. Was there a change with your the way you dressed on stage, and how did you evolve here into a show band?
Well, we went through a lot of changes in terms of the look and things like that. I think one of the cool things of that era was many bands were still dressing alike. So we had a collection of suits, styles of suits, herringbone style suits, things like that, that we wore on stage. It was either Honey Bear or Berman. Someone got the idea that we should wear tuxedos.
Well, for the convention center, we wore tuxes. We were
Yeah,
supposed to
I
dress
think that
up.
was the first time that we wore the tuxes, but we bought those tuxes and that became part of the wardrobe. They were ugly gray and white seersucker tuxedos.
Right. But it was kind of
But it was
what
cool.
the R&B bands were wearing at
Yeah.
that time. So it fit.
And as far as show band goes, somehow, were you also involved with the dancing in front?
Yes, he
You were,
was.
weren't you? You
As
were.
little as I could get away
That's who.
But it became part of the show,
We would do it. Yeah.
and we weren't just standing up there anymore
Land of a
playing.
Thousand
We were
Dances.
getting into it.
So with John Berman on the sax, does that
Yep.
also open up different songs and styles?
Well, it fit better with the rhythm and blues, of course.
And the other thing is at that point, in the whole show band point, Honey Bear would come out away from the keyboards and act as a lead singer from time to time. Louis was expanding his on-stage antics of doing flips and playing the
Who,
conga
me?
drum, and
Percussion instruments.
yeah, he was Mr. Tambourine Man for us.
I don't think I
But it,
played a
but it was
tambourine.
part of it was part of the show. But Honey Bear became very entertaining, being a comedian with the microphone and things like that, and it worked with the whole show band sound and stuff. Kent really helped steer the music, and Honey Bear helped steer the show, and of course Berman with his steps and everything. There was a natural flow to it.
All right, I'm very curious to hear about your gig with the Young Rascals in November 67. What's the story?
Well,
I wish it was a gig.
Yeah.
actually, Dick Shapiro, we were a good business unit. We were responsible.
Dependable.
We showed up for gigs. Ballroom owners loved us. We weren't the greatest band in the world, but we took care of it. We arrived on time and all those things. And Dick literally needed someone to pick up the Young Rascals and their equipment at the airport, get the equipment downtown to the Minneapolis Auditorium.
They were on a very tight time schedule.
Yeah, and it was I we got paid to do this for Dick, but in addition to that, we had front row seats and backstage passes, and we got to
Mingle with the
meet
Rascals.
and mingle with the Rascals, which was really it was a cool weekend. It's kind of odd when you think about it, because they played a Friday, or no, did they play Saturday night? It was a
Saturday
Saturday night
night.
show, but they came in on Friday, played Saturday, and then left on Sunday. You know, bands move a lot faster than that in today's world, but that's what the weekend was like.
Okay, so it wasn't really a gig, but you were assigned to help them out, and you actually rented a U-Haul trailer
Right.
Yep.
and met them at the airport.
Yeah, now the Hammond organ, of course, Bodine supplied that with the Leslies for Felix and so forth. But the drums and amps and all that, what we ripped off and put in our garage. No. And improved our equipment greatly. Now, we were responsible for getting that equipment from the airport down to the Minneapolis Auditorium.
So you got to hang out at the concert, and did you get to hang out backstage
Yeah.
with the
Oh, yeah, we
guys?
got pictures and
They were very, I mean, that experience was huge in that it was,
they weren't stuck up or anything. They were
no,
real down to earth.
Real
Some of the
down to earth.
nicest guys on the planet, really.
Yes.
And the other thing was is that they were as amazing as they sounded on record, seeing them in person and seeing them close up, you were absolutely blown away at their musical ability. They were really, really good. And we had never seen anything of that caliber to that point of a rock band. We were mesmerized. And
except for me, they had no bass player. No bass player. Felix Cavallari played bass with his feet on the pedals on his organ.
Okay, so besides Felix, they had Dino Danelli.
On drums.
Eddie Brigati.
Gene Cornish was the guitar.
Do you have any memories of talking to these guys? Any personal conversations?
I remember talking with Gene, and he was very cordial, very supportive, and a really good player. I mean, I'd never heard anybody quite like this in person myself, and I still have my Gene Cornish guitar pick in my collection somewhere that he gave me. Yeah, that's a big deal.
Scott's got Dino Danelli drumsticks. I don't recall if Dino gave those to you.
Yeah, I think they may have fallen out of one of his trap cases in the van.
So the next day you haul their equipment back to the airport and they're off to their next job.
Most of it.
We met most of the equipment, yeah. We met them at the airport, and there were fans there to see them off because it had leaked out.
Nobody knew when they came in, though.
Right.
That was
right.
Quiet.
Yeah, I think Louis leaked it, too.
Yeah, Louis was selling details to girls at the concert,
as I recall.
You want to come with us to the airport?
Hang out with the young rascals.
Yeah, you can hang out with us. But we met them at the airport, and again, now that's another thing. They remembered our names, and that part was pretty cool, you know, see them the next day and everything. But for us, we were on cloud nine. That was an incredible experience.
So what happens next in the history of the Nickel Revolution?
An interesting thing at this point is that Candy Floss had approached Dick Shapiro at Central Booking about working with their bands. And so what he did is he had all the band leaders come down for a meeting. Dale Menton and Peter Steinberg presented their ideas to the bands, and they would take another 10%, I believe it was, from the bands that wanted to work with Candy Floss, and that would be shaping the band's image, and of course recording the bands was the big hook that was attractive to a lot of bands. So the leaders then all took the information back to their band members, and people pretty much decided whether they wanted to go with Candy Floss or not. We thought it sounded like a good opportunity. We talked to other bands that were doing it, and so we, at that point, decided that we would contract with Candy Floss.
All right, and what's your first record that you record at Dove Recording Studio for Candy Floss, or the first songs you recorded?
You know, Candy Floss had us go in on our own, and that's actually when, again, Kent was helping shape the music direction of the band, and that's when we recorded Sweet Sweet Lovin' and Treat Her Right. That they really didn't control. It was just time that was given to us that we had coming from the agreement to record whatever we wanted. And so those are the songs that we elected. They were covers, and of course a lot of bands were doing covers at that point, but Sweet Sweet Lovin' was the Impressions.
I think it was The Platters, wasn't it?
Or The Platters, I'm sorry. Yes. You know the song.
I was just trying to remember. I think it was
The Platters.
No, it was The Platters. Kent's right. It was The Platters. And Roy Head was the one that had a hit with Treat Her Right. Not a big hit, but it was a cool song. It fit Ron Honey Bear perfectly. And so those were the two songs that we recorded. And fortunately, Kent was able to retrieve copies of those tapes so that we can have that music today.
So that's your first time in a recording studio in early 1968. What was it like?
You'd like to think that it was, you know, that you just really made it by going into the studio, but I remember being just terrified. You know, they really didn't want you to do anything more than once. And it, you know, heaven forbid you should make a mistake. It wasn't like the Beatles, you know, where they'd come in and control the studio for days on end. We'd get a couple hours, at first, and then as we got into this thing, we started taking over the better part of an evening, and it'd be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning before you'd get home. But
I think Kent understands what was the equipment, Kent, that the process that we record those on, because you recalled that pretty well.
3 tracks. And so you would.
We did all the instrumentation live.
Right.
And then a vocal track.
Right.
And that's all there was, correct? We didn't have two vocal tracks, did we?
Good question.
I don't think we did.
I don't know.
But I remember playing everything live, and nothing was direct.
Because we could bounce, and we'd have three passes at least, so.
Okay, and who was the engineer?
Arvidsson.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's
Arv is what he was called for short, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arv. Yeah, that's right.
All right. So you record the 2 songs, Sweet Lovin', Treat Her Right, and they do not come out as a 45, I understand.
No, they decided that they wouldn't do anything with it. You know, when I look back on it, I'm going, I think they should have put that out. It was just, because the recordings are decent. They still hold up today.
I ended up with the acetate, and I'm not sure why I got it or how I ended up with it, but I've had it all these years, and, you know, those things are only good for a couple of plays before they get pretty scratchy, and I think that thing's probably been played about 50 times. So when we were trying to find the copies of these recordings years later, it wasn't until Kent realized he had a reel-to-reel and actually had a pretty decent recording of it, because I'd taken it in and tried to get somebody to copy this thing over, and it wasn't going to work. But you go back and you listen to a lot of the songs that were being done in that era and by local groups, and there was a lot of good music out there, and I would have put these 2 songs up against anything that was out there. But for whatever reason, we got vetoed down, and it was never released. But it was okay because it was really more of a learning experience for us. We were just really pleased to get into the studio. It was worth every dime.
And just for the record, who's playing what on Sweet Lovin' and Treat Her Right?
Sweet Lovin', let's start with that. Well, it's going to be the same instrumentation for both songs. It is Kent Saunders, lead guitar and vocals, except Honey Bear sang Treat Her Right. But then Scott Jeffy on bass, myself, Jerry Lenz on drums, Louie Lenz on rhythm, John Berman on sax, and Honey Bear playing the keyboards. And we used all that same instrumentation on both songs.
Okay, what happens next with Candy Floss and the Nickel Revolution?
They come up with a new idea.
And that was, Louie?
Here Comes the Judge.
What was the background on Here Comes the Judge, or Here Come the Judge?
Came from that TV show, Laughing. And I got to tell you, in my opinion, that's the song that should have been pressed, because I thought that I didn't see any other version ever come out better than what had been done, and how Ron sang it in the Yiddish voice just was it made you think that you were watching Laughing by listening to that.
Who wrote the song?
Let's see here. We've got,
I think Dale Menton did. Dale was the one that really guided that song.
He was in the background laughing.
Yeah, he's the voice that you hear on that recording of somebody laughing uncontrollably, I think, is Dale Menton.
It is Dale Menton.
Yeah. And it might be a combination of Kent Saunders and Dale Menton there.
Laughing at the whole thing.
And also on the writer's credits are Barry Goldberg, Gary Pollack, and Pete Steinberg. So what do you recall about the session for Here Come the Judge?
Well, the whole idea for Honey Bear to do it with that accent was not planned at all. And it was, they just had us doing the song straight ahead, and quite frankly, we were all bored. And Honey Bear was more bored than anybody, because he's attempting to sing it. And just to goof off, he starts singing it in his Yiddish accent, and everybody starts laughing. And it was funny. It was so infectious that we went, whoa, this is what we've got to go with. And the song at that point was done in a flash, you know, because it really, really worked well.
If you gave Bear something like that, he went with it. He just loved having that kind of attention. He could go with something like that.
You can see one of the things I get a kick out of in the pictures is I'm sitting in a chair with headphones on while he's laying down the vocals, and we've got that picture today. I am just absolutely laughing my head off as he's singing it with that accent, but it was a lot of fun.
And you guys play all the instruments on that song?
Yeah.
Okay, so you get the song done. What happens?
Well, they went and shopped labels. What happened is as soon as the song was done, they had called their contacts, and there was a flood of people having the same idea
all over the country.
Consequently, record companies were flooded with different versions of Here Come the Judge. Two or three different versions actually made the charts within, I'm going to say, 2 or 3 weeks of us doing that. So there was no point in trying to release something that would have been a Me Too, other than it was...
ours was way different.
The most unique version, yes, of the song.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that Dale played the keyboard part on that because he kind of like showed us the tune.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And because I think that's kind of how Honey Bear ended up singing it. He was kind of like, "What am I going to do?" I think that's kind of how it happened, Kent.
Because I know Dale's spiel is on that thing. I'm pretty sure that's
Dale.
That is. It's one of the rare times where there's piano and not that organ. That typical Dove Studio, mm-hmm, organ.
I understand on March 8th, 1968, there was a concert held at the Metropolitan Sports Center in Bloomington called Super Scene 68. What do you guys recall about the concert? Scott or Jerry?
I still have a gold ticket to get in, so I'm waiting on it to reoccur. Now, it was a huge... At that time, radio stations were competing to have... WDGY and KDWB were competing who had the bigger shows all the time. So WDGY had packaged Super Scene, and they brought in Wilson Pickett, The Hollies, Strawberry Alarm Clock. There must have been a half a dozen local bands that played as well. So the idea was hours and hours and hours of music. And again, at that point, we are a show-type band with the tuxedos and everything. And the opportunity to see Wilson Pickett, that was my absolute favorite. That was incredible. The Hollies were excellent. It was fun to hear those vocals. And, of course, the Strawberry Alarm Clock was also one of the national acts. And, again, one of those funny stories. A very key part of their Incense and Peppermint, was their big hit, was Cowbell. And the drummer had forgot his cowbell on the trip from Chicago. Fortunately, I had a cowbell. And so my cowbell got played that night.
Wow.
On that song.
Nice. Scott, what do you recall about the Super Scene 68?
Not a lot, other than it was such a... It was weird because there was such a diverse type of music that these promoters would put together at that time frame. It wasn't all, you know, like today, all heavy metal or pop or something like that. It was just a mix. And I guess at the time, I'm not sure why they would have done it, but at the time it probably just drew in all kinds of people because you looked around the audience and there was, you know, all kinds of different ethnic groups of people, mm-hmm, coming to these types of shows. So it was all for one.
Kent, was that a good concert?
Yeah, I remember Wilson Pickett the most, too.
Was the place packed?
Yeah.
I think it was solidly packed. Yeah.
I would say one other thing. I was expecting the Strawberry Alarm Clock to be better, but they sound like another local band compared to the Hollies and Wilson Pickett. Of course, Wilson Pickett show is just, you know, that's phenomenal, so... I'm trying to think of who, I think Michael and the Mystics were one of the other groups playing that night. Can't remember all the local groups that played. Connie Hector from Connie's Insider wrote about it, and it was pretty interesting what he wrote in his column about that show. But he complimented us a lot on hearing the band and things like that. Don't remember exactly what he said. We had it in one of the Connie's insiders that Scott found somewhere. But it was interesting to read again many, many years later the account of the show. But it was one of the coolest things. Like, even if you weren't in a band, to have been at that show, and even to this day, people will say to me, "You actually played with Wilson Pickett?" And it's like, yeah, we really did. I mean, it isn't like we were locker mates, but, you know, we played in the same building.
And I understand shortly after that concert, there were some changes in the lineup of Nickel Revolution.
The music business was so fast-paced at that time. And what was hot, you know, yesterday is no longer hot today. And we were looking at all kinds of new types of music being played on the radio, and we're thinking, yeah, we want to do some of that stuff now. It just, everybody was thinking about different ways to go, and people just moved on and went on to play the kinds of music that they enjoyed.
One of the things that is very important, because it's 1968, when I started chronicling things on the Nickel Revolution, I discovered some just glazing examples of what a year of change 1968 was. Now, Kent and John Berman would continue in the R&B vein and go on to help form a group called the Blues Cube. Is that correct?
We became part of that band.
Okay.
Because that was an extension of Marsha and the Lynchmen.
Right, right.
So the band was already formed.
So they were going in the R&B direction. And when you look at 1968 and all the things that happened, I mean, there's real unfortunate things like assassinations, the student demonstrations, and protests against the war. There was a new expression of music, and you can look at the charts and see that there's a conflict between the music. There's the good stuff and what I call the R&B and the pop. But there's this influence of
underground music.
There was anger because friends are going off to war, and the music changed, the clothes changed, the hair got longer. I mean, it was what Scott was saying. It was fast paced. That year went very rapidly with a lot of changes and a lot of different things going on. That was part of it.
So the show band version of Nickel Revolution comes to an end. And how would you describe now the new version of Nickel Revolution?
Well, it's at this point that Keith Luhr joins on guitar and vocals. So at that point, Ron Honeybear Hort on keyboards and vocals, Keith Luhr on guitar and vocals, Scott Jeffy on bass, Louie on rhythm, and myself on the drums. Keith brought with him, this is very interesting, our second Keith, brings with him original songs, writing, and actually doing different versions of songs and making them a little bit edgier and rockier.
I think it was after Ron was gone that Keith started writing the original songs, if you think back now.
True, but that's when he really hit his stride. But
yeah,
he did bring with him
a whole
songs.
Different guitar.
And up to that point, none of us had even thought about, well, other than maybe Kent, but none of us had even thought about writing songs, whether we could even do it. And Keith would show up with a little piece of paper with some lyrics on it and just some chords. And we all had to come up with our own parts. And it was just fascinating to be able to do something like that. We'd never thought we could.
Don't you remember the night that we found Keith? Kent had come back from a gig that you were playing, I think, in Eau Claire, and we were in Menominee. And I'll never forget Kent. He was so excited to get to play two gigs and make two paychecks, but he gets a speeding ticket between the gigs. And so we announced that night that we're looking for a lead guitar player, correct? Keith Luhr came out of the crowd. That's how we found him.
Oh, wow.
You remember that, yes?
I don't remember him coming at that time, but I do remember everything else he related. I remember
I bet.
Racing between two jobs.
If it isn't true, it's an interesting story.
Well, I think he played on stage with us that night.
Okay, so you have now kind of a new hard rock sound. Is there a change in the physical appearance of the band?
Oh, yeah.
There's a very big change. You can talk about the clothes, Louis.
Well, now we go to the Nehru tops, the real wide bell bottoms. In fact, I had a pair with the Nickel Revolution design on the sides. We even went to Chicago shopping
to buy
for
clothes. Yep.
Yes, we went there at least twice. And so, yeah, we became more psychedelic, I guess is the right word to say.
But it also opened up some dangerous parts of our career. At that point, you were looked down upon if you had hair that went over your ears.
We had long hair.
We had long hair, fringe jackets, and we were trying to fit that mold of, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast, and not a lot of people in the Twin Cities were doing that type of thing. And you hit the rural areas of the five-state area.
Interesting contrast. It's at this point that Candy Floss has us pegged to record a novelty song and assigns Oscar Crunch to us as a band. That's a stark contrast to what we just described as musically what we were becoming. And it involved a contest that Mercury Records put together with Connie Hector for the Connie Awards and Connie's Insider, that a contract would be awarded to a local band to produce a single. That's exactly what happened. Oscar Crunch was a song submitted by the Nickel Revolution, which we never really did, and there were other songs submitted, but that record was selected by Mercury to...
It won the best.
A follow-up for the Singing Nun, I believe it was.
and it won Best New Material at the Connie Awards. And we were kind of surprised because it wasn't something that we were really looking forward to promoting or being part of. And yet at the same time, all the stars aligned and all the moons aligned, and all of a sudden we've got a recording contract.
So when you show up at Dove Recording to record Oscar Crunch, what happens?
The song's already done except for the background vocals.
Done by who?
Barry Goldberg.
Pete Steinberg.
Pete Steinberg.
Dale Menton.
I don't think Pete sang on it, though.
No,
he didn't sing. He didn't play any instruments. It was Barry Goldberg, Gary Pollack. Those two for sure sang on that.
Was Arnie involved at all then?
Arnie Fogel wasn't involved.
Dale was, for sure.
Yeah.
So I think it was Dale, Barry, and...
I mean, as I recall it, these guys sat around and just churned out songs, and they came up with all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And was Whip Lane on the drums?
Yes. So it was basically the Puddle that really had... It was their song. But Candy Floss used the Nickel Revolution because they wanted a local band that had a following attached to it.
Okay, so what part do you guys do on Oscar Crunch?
Well, no, we did the background vocals.
But in all fairness, at that point, Jerry sounded exactly like whoever was singing the lead on it. And so when we went on the road with this song, we were able to sound exactly like the record, which was, in my estimation, pretty amazing.
And even though they made it probably because of Bear... You're right. It was Gerald's voice.
He was the one that could sound almost pitch perfect to the record.
So who in the Nickel Revolution is singing background on Oscar Crunch?
All of us.
All right.
Yeah, it was let's see, to make it real simple, it would be Ron, Scott, Louis, Jerry.
And Kent.
And
Keith.
No,
or
Keith.
Keith, sorry.